recognizing Panama. The little republic had just constituted herself into a tripartite democracy and elected Manuel Amador as its first president. Encouraged by these developments and by a positive legal argument by Elihu Root, published in the morning's newspapers, the Senate voted in favor of the treaty, 66-14. Roosevelt and his successors were given power in perpetuity over the canal zone, 10 miles wide, dividing Panama into two provinces and extending 3 miles out to sea each way. The power, though not technically absolute, was what the United States would possess and exercise if it were the sovereign of the territory, to the entire exclusion of the exercise by the Republic of Panama of any such sovereign rights, power, or authority. It was dread of such provisions that had caused old Amador to totter in Bonavarria's arms. The original Hay-Iran Treaty had called for a 99-year renewable lease and a much narrower canal zone, but Bonavarria had been so anxious to achieve ratification that Panamanians already felt he had mortgaged their future. Instead of becoming a hero of the people he had helped liberate, he incurred their lasting resentment. Bonavarria triumphantly resigned as Panamanian minister, stating that he would accept no salary for his services. It was enough that the great idea could now be realized, for the honor of Panama and for the glory of France and of the United States. Few Americans imagined, as Secretary Shaw prepared to disburse $10 million as down payment on the zone, J.P. Morgan and Company, agents, that Amador could be anything but pleased. An enormous map in the White House enabled Roosevelt to keep pace with the Russo-Japanese War. He pinned it with little flags to show the movement of forces. Japan is playing our game. Browsed weekly bulletins from the Office of Naval Intelligence and wondered if he might not have to mediate a peace settlement one day. At present, the belligerents simply wanted to destroy each other. Japan, flush with naval success, was ready for a land battle. Russia would soon strike back. The world waited. Cecil Spring Rice, now Secretary of the British Embassy in St. Petersburg, wrote to say that Russia was obsessed with expanding eastward as well as westward. "There has been nothing like it since Tamerlane, the whole of Asia and half Europe." He foresaw problems with Muslims one day, but who could ultimately resist a bear so big, so blindly driven? Roosevelt, replying, looked instead to a victorious Japan as the great new force in the Far East. Should Korea and China proceed to develop themselves along Japanese lines, there will result a real shifting of the center of equilibrium as far as the white races are concerned. He was philosophical about this. If new nations come to power, the attitude of we who speak English should be one of ready recognition of the rights of the newcomers, of desire to avoid giving them just offense, and at the same time of preparedness in body and in mind to hold our own if our interests are menaced. On Monday, 14 March, both Wall Street and the White House opened nervously for business. The Supreme Court was expected during the course of the day to announce its decision in U.S. versus Northern Securities. Reports were that the decision would be very drastic, perhaps worse for railroad interests than last year's lower court ruling. "All I can do is hope," Roosevelt told friends. Of one justice, at least, he could be sure. Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. had so far proved a grateful supporter of administration policies. During the Alaska boundary negotiations in London, Holmes had worked discreetly to soothe British sensibilities, riled by the president's official commissioners. He called at the White House more often and less formally than any other justice, and was quite capable of teasing Roosevelt for self-righteousness. "The king, of course, can do no wrong." Justice William Rufus Day, Roosevelt's second appointee to the bench, in place of the wistful Taft, was a self-effacing little man of mild liberal tendencies. He, too, could be relied on. Justice David J. Brewer certainly could not, being an ultra-conservative, patrician ideologue. The other Republicans on the bench were less predictable. Noisy old John Marshall Harlan, the last of the tobacco-spitting judges, Holmes fondly called him, was a libertarian and a maverick. He had been against monopoly in the past, dissenting in U.S. versus E.C. Knight, but was wary of too much federal power. Just as Henry Brown was such a cold-blooded legal theorist, analyzing the statute books as if they were so many volumes of algebra, that he was capable of finding that X equaled Y in the face of unanimous sentiment for Z. Just as Joseph McKenna was an austere plotter, ill-trained in law, and crotchety on issues he could not understand. On the Democratic side, Chief Justice Melville W. Fuller and Justices Rufus Peckham and Edward D. White were conservatives of uncertain persuasion. They seemed likely to vote against the government, although Roosevelt had hopes of the affable White. By noon, the court chamber in the Capitol was crowded with representatives of all three government branches. Attorney General Knox sat directly in front of the bench, exuding his usual porcelain impassivity. William Howard Taft sprawled nearby, a beached whale. Senators Spooner and Lodge conferred in low voices at the bar. Oh yes," the clerk cried. Silence fell as nine justices filed in, silk robes rustling. The attendance of Justice Brown, who was ill, emphasized the importance of the proceedings. Chief Justice Fuller seated himself and waited until the chamber had settled. Two dozen reporters standing at the back of the chamber craned to see which way his white head would swivel. He turned to the right and nodded at Oliver Wendell Holmes. Holmes proceeded to read, in his clear, sharp voice, a decree reversal of no popular interest whatever. The audience slumped disappointedly. After about 5 minutes, silence fell again. Fuller gave a second nod, and Justice Harlan announced, "Case number 277. Instantly there was a scurrying of shoes, as messengers rushed off to alert congressmen that Northern Securities was up. Within minutes, the corridor was jammed all the way to the rotunda. "Let us see what are the facts disclosed by the record," Harlan began. He showed how in 1901, Defendant Hill and Defendant Morgan had combined the Great Northern and Northern Pacific Railroads into a holding company headquartered in New Jersey, thus making the interests of all stockholders identical. No scheme or device could more certainly come within the words of the Sherman Act, or could more effectively and certainly suppress free competition. Harlan's strong, measured voice continued to rise and fall, but evidently the administration had won its case. The messengers scurried off again, this time to telegraph and telephone offices. Harlan was still reading when they got back. He did not reach his summation until 1:20. "The judgment of the court is that the decree below be, and hereby is, affirmed." Cables flashed across the country. "Northern Securities decision affirmed." It was 5 minutes before someone thought to telephone the president, who was just sitting down to lunch with John Hay. Roosevelt was overjoyed, but declined to comment. William Loeb told reporters that the president felt the victory belonged to Knox. The dimensions of that victory were still unclear. Back in court, Justice Brewer struck an encouraging note as he concurred with the decision, then a discouraging one, as he rejected Harlan's opinion. But he offered another of his own, proposing a rule of reason that would prevent wholesale antitrust proclamations. Justices Day, Brown, and McKenna joined the majority. Fuller, Peckham, and White opposed, making the verdict so far 5-3. Only one more vote was needed to make Roosevelt's victory decisive. Justice Holmes dissented. "Great cases," he lectured the stupefied audience, "like hard cases, make bad law, for great cases are called great, not by reason of their real importance in shaping the law of the future, but because of some accident of immediate overwhelming interest, which appeals to the feelings and distorts the judgment." He seemed to be implying that an accident of immediate overwhelming interest, named Theodore Roosevelt, had made an emotional issue of Northern Securities and was exaggerating its legal significance. The statute of which we have to find the meaning is a criminal statute of a very sweeping and general character. It hits every contract or combination of the prohibited sort, great or small, and every person who shall monopolize or attempt to monopolize the sense of the act, any part of the trade or commerce among the several states. There is a natural inclination to assume that it was directed against certain great combinations, and to read it in that light. It does not say so. On the contrary, it says, every and any part. Still was it directed specially against railroads. If the act before us is to be carried out according to what seems to me to be the logic of the argument for the government, which I do not believe that it will be, I can see no part of the conduct of life with which, on similar principles, Congress might not interfere, and hardly any transaction concerning commerce between the states that may not be made a crime by the finding of a jury or a court. Holmes pointed out that the Sherman Act forbade only combinations in restraint of trade, not combinations in restraint of competition. He saw no evidence that the Northern Securities Company had attempted to monopolize some portion of the trade or commerce of the realm. Nor had it discriminated against strangers to its charter. He rejected Knox's plea that mere power to discriminate was as culpable as discrimination itself. What was monopoly, anyway? A single railroad running down a narrow valley could be said to monopolize local traffic. Yet I suppose, Holmes scoffed, no one would say the statute forbids a combination of men into a corporation to build and run such a railroad in the United States. Neither could the sheer size of Northern Securities be equated with monopoly. Size has nothing to do with the matter. The justice concluded with a sarcastic reference to the narrowness of today's verdict. I am happy to know that only a minority of my brethren adopt an interpretation of the Sherman law which, in my opinion, would make eternal the bellum omnium contra omnes, and disintegrate society so far as it could into individual atoms. If that were its intent, I should regard calling such a law a regulation of commerce as a mere pretense. It would be an attempt to reorganize society. I am not concerned with the wisdom of such an attempt, but I believe that Congress was not entrusted by the Constitution with the power to make it, and I am deeply persuaded that it has not tried. So, by a margin of just one concurring vote, case number 277 sank to the footnotes of history. John Hay, who personally disapproved of antitrust actions, was struck by the bitterness of the president's remarks about Holmes in the days following. "I could carve out of a banana a judge with more backbone than that," Roosevelt raged. Holmes had not behaved like a party man, a constructive statesman. For a while it seemed that the justice was going to become persona non grata at the White House, but Roosevelt's sudden storms were short. "I have such confidence in his great-heartedness," Holmes wrote a friend, "that I don't expect for a moment that after he has had time to cool down, it will affect our relations." Knox and Taft joined in lamenting the closeness of the decision. Popularly, however, it was perceived as a big victory for democracy over monopoly. 9 out of 10 national newspapers congratulated the president. The case both dramatized and demonstrated the latent strength of the Sherman Act. As the New York Evening Post remarked, the fundamental question of Northern Securities versus U.S., to what extent might combination freely proceed, was answered, not much without popular approval. Surely the most far-reaching benefit of the decision is the vindication of national control. The New York World agreed, but worried about placing such control in the hands of Theodore Roosevelt. He had already broadened the use of executive power in labor mediation, in foreign policy, and in federal patronage. Now he had dissolved the world's second-largest trust. Imagine the demagogue as president, armed with all the legitimate power of an office grown greater than man had dreamed was possible. He is everything. He is power. He is patronage. He is privilege. The three men most affected by the decision reacted with surprising equanimity. J.P. Morgan puffed serenely on a cigar, smiled, and waggled his great head at reporters. E.H. Harriman turned defeat into victory by suing for his old Northern Pacific stock at a huge profit. James J. Hill put on a brave public face, saying, "The three railroads are still there, earning good money." Only in private was he critical of the president as an aspirant king, surrounded by gilded flunkies. Roosevelt persuaded himself that the case had ended happily, in spite of Justice Holmes's dissent. If he had not achieved the historic review he dreamed of, he had won a temporal accord that redressed the balance between government and free enterprise. Washington resounded with praise and predictions of four more Rooseveltian years. "As far as I can see," Joseph Buckland Bishop wrote in the Commercial Advertiser, "there is no need of an election." By 1 April, Washington was efflorescent with cherry blossom, 1.25 million new bulbs splotched parks and roadsides. To Roosevelt, who since Groundhog Day had been hopefully snapping twigs for signs of sap, the warming sunshine felt especially pleasant. Mrs. J. Borden Harriman, remembering him as a boy, found him boylike still, the embodiment of spring, bubbling with life and hope. An administration bill to set up American government in the Panama Canal Zone was set for passage, and the nation's economy was improving. So were his jiu-jitsu skills. Indeed, he had just shown how the latter could be adapted to politics by grabbing a pension measure right out of the hands of Congress and flipping it into an executive order of his own. Veterans now found that they were eligible for benefits at the early age of 62, and their gratitude was sure to translate into a huge number of votes in November. As always, when the president was happy, his happiness touched those around him. "He is a very sweet and natural man, and a very trusting man," William Howard Taft wrote. "I am growing to be very fond of him." Even so, Roosevelt's bright spring was not entirely cloudless. William Randolph Hearst seemed intent on a populist campaign for the presidency. Meanwhile, old guard Republicans were insisting that lanky, awful Charles W. Icicle Fairbanks be nominated for vice president. He was the senior senator from Indiana, a tireless speaker, and Wall Street's darling. "Who in the name of heaven else is there?" Roosevelt asked, not expecting any answer. A long-simmering foreign policy crisis also threatened to embarrass him at a time when he did not want any more accusations of gunboat diplomacy. It was virtually a repeat of the Venezuelan affair of 1902 to 1903, transposed to the Dominican Republic. Again, an impoverished Caribbean nation could not pay its debts. Again, Germany was an impatient creditor. Again, the United States Navy had conducted exercises off Isla de Culebra in a choreographed evocation of the Monroe Doctrine. So far, Wilhelm II had sent in no warships, only a fulsome letter to Roosevelt, unfortunately not reproducible at the Republican National Convention. "Your unlimited power for work, dauntless energy of purpose, pureness of motives moving towards the highest ideals, this all crowned by an iron will, form qualities which elicit the highest admiration from everybody over here. They are the characteristics of a man, and as such most sympathetic to me. The 20th century is sadly in want of men of your stamp at the head of great nations. Thank heaven the Anglo-Saxon Germanic race is still able to produce such a specimen. You must accept it as a fact that your figure has moved to the foreground of the world, and that men's minds are intensely occupied by you." The Kaiser could yet turn nasty if Roosevelt did not make good his own corollary to the Monroe Doctrine and place Santo Domingo under American receivership. Juan Franco Sanchez, the Dominican Minister of Foreign Affairs, was in Washington practically begging for annexation. Roosevelt saw political problems if he agreed. Any new protectorate, coinciding with his acquisition of the Canal Zone, was likely to reactivate the pesky anti-imperialist league and give the Democrats a major campaign issue. Cuba was libre, and the Philippines, thanks to Taft, pretty well pacified. His own youthful appetite for empire was gone. He searched for a simile strong enough to express his distaste for another insular possession. I have about the same desire to annex it as a gorged boa constrictor might have to swallow a porcupine, wrong end too. 2 months after Mark Hanna's death, the question of who should be the new chairman of the Republican National Committee had not been resolved. Elihu Root, prospering hugely as a Wall Street attorney, declined to serve. 3 other candidates pleaded ill health: Henry Clay Payne of Wisconsin, Winthrop Murray Crane of Massachusetts, and the septuagenarian Cornelius N. Bliss of New York. The last, a veteran of McKinley's first cabinet, had such excellent corporate connections, not to mention stainless honor and purity, that Roosevelt urged him to reconsider. Bliss said he would think about it. In the meantime, the president felt free to set his own Republican agenda in a series of indiscretions calculated to heave fresh sod on Hanna's grave. He preached conservation to the National Wholesale Lumber Dealers Association and political morality to Republican professionals. He meddled in the gubernatorial politics of New York and Missouri, ordered a draft platform for the convention, considered and approved a mysterious proposal to translate American campaign literature into Bohemian, and grossly flattered the First National Assembly of American periodical publishers. It is always a pleasure for a man in public life to meet the real governing classes. Hearing that some desperate Democrats were trying to persuade Grover Cleveland to run against him, he circulated among newspaper editors, "For your private use," a note from the former president that appeared to support his labor policies during the coal strike. Cleveland fumed with rage. "I am amazed at Roosevelt. There are some people in this country that need lessons in decency and good manners." Theodore thinks of nothing, talks of nothing, and lives for nothing but his political interests, Henry Adams noted. If you remark to him that God is great, he asks naively how that will affect his election. Old Guard Republicans worried about the undignified spectacle of a president campaigning for his own office. He was supposed to put himself in the hands of party professionals. McKinley had successfully sat out 2 campaigns at home in Canton, Ohio. Here was Teddy virtually setting up pre-convention headquarters in the White House. The most that conservatives could do, until the party organized itself at the National Convention in June, was beg Roosevelt not to go public with his spring exercise schedule, lest tabloid newspapers beholden to William Randolph Hearst depict him as a clown, or, worse still, a snob. Skinny-dipping in Rock Creek Park, rough-riding on Bleistein, and tennis, that effete Anglophile pastime of the rich, all carried a high degree of political risk. Aides shuddered at the memory of last year's tour bus megaphones on West Executive Avenue. Reluctantly, in view of the marvelous weather, the president continued to exercise indoors. After some vain efforts to strangle his Japanese wrestling instructor, he managed 3 new throws that were perfect corkers. As a result, he was mottled all over with bruises and lame in both big toes, the right ankle, left wrist, and thumb. His signature fingers still worked, however. On 28 April, he scrawled Theodore Roosevelt at the bottom of the last sheet of legislation to come his way before Congress adjourned. An act to provide for the temporary government of the canal zone at Panama, the protection of the canal works, and other purposes. Simultaneously in Paris, documents confirming the sale and conveyance of French rights were signed. Thus, as the largest real estate transaction in history was consummated, the largest engineering project in history was begun. Philippe Bonneau-Varilla, who had waited in New York for this moment, sailed for France. His last request of Panama was that the diplomatic salary he had declined should be put toward a monument to Ferdinand de Lesseps, the canal's progenitor. For better or worse, the completed waterway, he could see it already, blue and brimming from Gatun to Balboa, would be identified with a more contemporary hero. Both men would always, for him, merit the supreme adjective, great. I have taken possession of and now occupy, on behalf of the United States, the canal zone and public land ceded by the Republic of Panama, Roosevelt announced. By terms of treaty and act, he could exercise as much military, civil, and judicial authority as he liked in the zone, but he immediately delegated this authority to his Secretary of War. Taft was a proven, brilliant colonial administrator, sensitive to native pride. The Panamanians, who showed early signs of being temperamental neighbors, would be soothed by him. "A more high-minded and disinterested man does not live," Roosevelt wrote fondly. He sent Taft an official letter, stipulating a government and constitution for the zone in precise, peremptory language. Power was to be invested in a new, 7-man Isthmian Canal Commission, already appointed. This would be chaired, as the old commission had been, by Admiral John G. Walker. Major General George W. Davis, USMC, was appointed governor of the zone. All but one of the other commission members were engineers. Roosevelt ordered Taft to supervise and direct this body, as he had the Philippines Commission. On the plainly administrative level, it could be trusted to regulate, recruit, survey, purchase, and disperse. The basic privileges of the Bill of Rights were guaranteed to all inhabitants of the zone, except, as he robustly specified, idiots, the insane, epileptics, paupers, criminals, professional beggars, and persons afflicted with loathsome or dangerous contagious diseases. For good measure, he threw in felons, anarchists, and insurrectos. Sanitary reform, along the lines of General Wood's pioneering work in Havana, was a matter of first importance, the president wrote. I desire that every possible effort be made to protect our officers and workmen from the dangers of tropical and other diseases, which in the past have been so prevalent and destructive in Panama. On 10 May, Cornelius Bliss formally declined the party chairmanship. A few days later, J. Hampton Moore, leader of the youth-oriented National Republican League, hurried to Washington to press the name of Senator Boies Penrose of Pennsylvania. Roosevelt could not see Moore until the late afternoon. "You might as well know," the president said, "that I shall recommend George B. Cortelyou." Shadows stole across the lawn outside, darkening the executive office windows. Moore stared at Roosevelt, trying to gauge his expression. Was that a smile or a grin? Perhaps he was baring his teeth in anticipation of a fight, because this appointment was sure to upset the Republican old guard. They would want to know how an impoverished ex-stenographer, not quite 42, could possibly raise millions of dollars from the likes of J.P. Morgan, let alone manage the immense complexity of a national campaign. Roosevelt seemed to have no such doubts. He rambled on about how young Republicans might help him win in November. Both he and Moore were aware that, even as they talked, an old guard stalwart lay near death in the reddening hills of western Pennsylvania. Senator Matthew Quay, master manipulator of so many national conventions, had bought his last delegate. So had Mark Hanna, already nothing more than a name set in stone in Cleveland. Farther west still, in Wisconsin, the political careers of John Coit Spooner and Henry Clay Payne were in decline. Governor La Follette had completed his takeover of that state's organization and was threatening to send a radical delegation to Chicago. "The last consignment of great captains of the Republican Party are passing into the twilight," the New York Sun mourned. Even that venerable newspaper, expositor of corporate conservatism for so many years, had had its day. Its famous symbol, an orb half hidden behind a black mountain, looked more like dusk than dawn. The president beamed at his visitor, showing no regret for Tempus Perdu. Few people realized it, but Roosevelt loved Quay, probably the most despised politician of the last 20 years. He had made a secret pilgrimage to say goodbye, and been moved by Quay's lament, "I do wish it were possible for me to get off into the great north woods and crawl out on a rock in the sun and die like a wolf." Public men of the future must face a brighter, more businesslike light, the shadow-free light of Cooper Hewitt lamps and popping press bulbs and Luxfer office windows. George Cortelyou, stenographer, scheduler, filer, colorless as onion skin, the quintessential modern bureaucrat, did not blink at this kind of light. Neither did Moore's young Republicans. "Go see Cortelyou as soon as you can," the president said. And tell him, he added ingratiatingly, I want him to work with you. Chapter 21. The Wire That Ran Around the World. I hope you're satisfied, he says. I am, says John Hay. At 64 years of age, Jan Perdicaris, John to boyhood friends in New Jersey, felt that he had found his final home in Tangier, Morocco. His dividends from United States cotton and gas stocks financed a palatial villa outside of town, on the slopes of Jebel Kabir. This did not mean that Mr. Perdicaris had severed all American ties. Cultured and suave, he made a point of entertaining visiting compatriots, and enjoyed his role as dean of Tangier's little English-speaking colony. When the mood struck him, he was capable of crossing to New York, renting the Fifth Avenue Theater, and putting on a show scripted by himself, with sets by I. Perdicaris and his own stepdaughter as star. Such shows might open on Monday and close the following Thursday, but Mr. Perdicaris was wealthy enough to be philosophical, returning always to the peace of his Moroccan retreat. He sat there now on the cool evening of 18 May 1904, relaxed in dinner jacket and pumps, surrounded by his family and the luxurious jumble of a cosmopolitan life. Tiny amphorae on the mantel testified to his birth in Athens, where his father had been United States Consul General. Oriental rugs and American skins bestrewed the floor. Moorish tables and shelves displayed a collection of objets d'art from three continents. William Morris wallpaper hinted that the lady of the house was an Englishwoman. Mrs. Perdicaris, however, was as happily expatriate as her husband. She liked to cuddle two Brazilian monkeys who ate orange blossoms out of a pouch slung round her waist. The other male member of the party was her son, Cromwell Varley. He was younger than his stepfather by some 20 years, but when sudden screams came from down the hallway, the old man lithely beat him to the door. Mr. Perdicaris supposed, as he ran, that his French chef was quarreling with the German housekeeper, as usual. Not until he reached the servants' quarters, with Varley following, did he realize that bandits had invaded his property. Armed Moors approached him, pausing only to club his butler to the floor with rifle butts. Mr. Perdicaris tried to intervene. He was instantly beaten and bound with palmetto cords. Varley leaped forward, enraged, whereupon his hand was slashed, and he, too, taken prisoner. The rifles prodded both men toward the guardhouse, where a handsome, short, pale, turbaned Berber introduced himself. "I am the Rasuli." Mr. Perdicaris was not encouraged. Ahmed ben Mohammed el Rasuli was a notorious insurgent, ruling three of the most violent hill tribes in Morocco, the Arif Mountain Kabyles, whom Sultan Moulay Abdulaziz IV had never been able to subdue. Captured once by the Pasha of Tangier, Rasuli had spent 4 years chained to a wall. Since then, his hatred of the French-dominated sultanate had become compulsive. Yet his voice tonight was low and unthreatening. "I swear by all we hold sacred," Rasuli said, indicating Mr. Perdicaris's other servants, "that if there is no attempt to escape or rescue, no harm shall come to these people, but they must mount and ride with us." Mr. Perdicaris saw his own horses being saddled for travel. He had no idea why he was being abducted. "I accept your assurance, Rasuli," he replied in Arabic. He and Varley were made to mount, too. A small caravan formed and trotted out into the darkness. Helpless and hysterical, Mrs. Perdicaris remained behind. Then she discovered that Rasuli had neglected to cut the villa's telephone cord. Just before 11 o'clock, Samuel Gummery, the American consul general in Tangier, rode up through the cork trees to comfort her. The first cable from Gummery did not reach the State Department until early afternoon of the next day, 19 May. Mr. Perdicaris, most prominent American citizen here, and his stepson Mr. Varley, British subject, were carried off last night from their country house, 3 miles from Tangier, by a numerous band of natives headed by Rasuli. I earnestly request that a man of war be sent at once. Situation most serious. John Hay was out of town, so once again Assistant Secretary of State Francis B. Loomis had to handle a foreign crisis with the President. Conveniently, Roosevelt had just dispatched 16 white warships on a goodwill cruise of the Mediterranean. His response was quick and more forceful than Gummery could have hoped. Loomis cabled back that some of these ships would be sent to Tangier as soon as possible, maybe 3 or 4 days before one can arrive. His estimate was somewhat optimistic. The nearest ships to Morocco were those of Rear Admiral French E. Chadwick's South Atlantic Squadron, comprising the fast cruiser Brooklyn, a protected cruiser, and 2 gunboats. About 1 day behind steamed 4 big battleships of the North Atlantic Fleet, under Rear Admiral Albert S. Barker. Bringing up the rear was Rear Admiral Theodore F. Jewell's European Squadron of 3 protected cruisers. The last 7 units were scheduled to rendezvous in the Azores before proceeding to Portugal and the Rivieras. Chadwick's 4 were due to visit Gibraltar and then tour the North African coast. These were the vessels Roosevelt chose to divert to Tangier, but he overestimated the speed at which even the Brooklyn could move. The Navy Department advised that Chadwick would not reach Tangier much before the end of May. Rasuli's caravan jogged inland all day, under the staring sun. Mr. Perticaris and his stepson, stifled under Moorish hikes, wrapped around them for disguise. Toward evening they ascended into the Rif Mountains, tribal country forbidden to Christians and coastal Arabs alike. Mr. Perticaris's horse slipped on some rocks. The old man, still bound, was thrown off, dislocating a thigh bone. He lay quivering until Varley and Rasuli lifted him back onto the saddle. For hours the climb continued up a wet, dark gorge. Shortly before midnight, Rasuli called a halt at the village of Saradan, on the spur of Mount Nazul. Mr. Perticaris was escorted to a hut that reeked of stagnant water. Unable to stand on his throbbing leg, he lay down on the clay floor, and someone threw a blanket over him. He could not sleep. The hut's thatch was half open to the sky. Rain began to fall, softening the clay to paste. In all his wandering life, Mr. Perticaris had never felt so remote from help or hope. Roosevelt's armada steamed on across the Atlantic, leaving the Caribbean basin unguarded. As if to remind its citizens that out of sight was not out of mind, the President chose 20 May, the 2nd anniversary of Cuba Libre, to make an official statement of his corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. Once again, Elihu Root served as his spokesman. Addressing the Cuba Society of New York that evening, Root asked permission to read a letter from the President of the United States. Its first 2 paragraphs were blandly congratulatory, but there was a passing clause that caught attention. It is not true that the United States has any land hunger or entertains any projects as regards other nations, save such as are for their welfare. The 3rd paragraph moved quickly from reassurance to threat. If a nation shows that it knows how to act with decency in industrial and political matters, if it keeps order and pays its obligations, then it need fear no interference from the United States. Brutal wrongdoing, or an impotence which results in a general loosening of the ties of a civilized society, may finally require intervention by some civilized nation, and in the Western Hemisphere the United States cannot ignore this duty, but it remains true that our interests and those of our southern neighbors are in reality identical. The letter ended as it began, with polite clichés, but its message was clear. Caribbean and Latin American countries must in future match their interests to those of the Colossus of the North. If not, they would be policed. In sending such a message at such a time, little more than 4 weeks before the Republican National Convention, Roosevelt took a calculated risk. Better, with mere rhetoric, to arouse a chorus of criticism from anti-imperialists than to court much wider outrage by actually implementing the corollary if things got any worse in Santo Domingo. His statement should at least reduce the latter possibility through November. Congressman David DeArmond of Missouri accused him in the New York World of jingoism run mad. The same newspaper also used the word mad along with patronizing, menace, knight-errantry, and bumptiousness. Yet most commentators north and south of the border praised the president's good intentions. Memories of German and British gunboats bombarding Venezuela still rankled. For better or worse, the Roosevelt corollary was now a permanent feature of hemispheric policy. "I ask nothing from you," Rasuli told Mr. Perdicaris, much to the latter's relief. However, Rasuli clearly intended to ask a great deal from the Sultan of Morocco before he released so valuable a pair of hostages, and was content to let international pressure build for their release. At his leisure, he sent Abdulaziz a list of his demands and settled down to the life of a village celebrity. He strolled around Saradan, accepting the adoration of youths who kissed the hem of his burnous. When Mr. Perdicaris asked what he wanted from Fez, Rasuli mentioned 5 specific concessions: an end to harassment of the Erifs by government forces, release of all Kabyle political prisoners, dismissal of the Pasha who had chained him, a ransom of 70,000 Spanish silver dollars, finally, elevation to overlordship of 2 of Morocco's richest districts. Mr. Perdicaris was aghast and depressed at the extravagance of these terms. Rasuli showed him a plait braided under his turban. "This will disappear only when my wrongs are avenged, mine and those of my people." A few days later, word came that Sultan Abdulaziz was not interested in bargaining for foreign hostages. Rasuli promptly had the imperial messenger's throat slit. Roosevelt's redefinition of the Monroe Doctrine and his dispatch of warships to the Mediterranean were the gestures of a palpably confident executive. "I had much rather be a real president for 3 years and a half," he told George Otto Trevelyan, "than a figurehead for 7 years and a half." The odds on renewed real power were in his favor. With 708 out of 988 convention delegates pledged to him, his nomination was now a certainty. Democrat campaign planners were in such despair over his popularity that, having failed to persuade Grover Cleveland to run, they seemed likely to settle for Alton B. Parker, a New York state judge who, as Elihu Root remarked, has never opened his mouth on any national question. Reticence and its political cousin, caginess, were, in Roosevelt's opinion, weaknesses to be taken advantage of. When a deputation of conservative senators, including Aldrich and Spooner, visited the White House to protest his selection of the inexperienced Cordelieu as chairman of the Republican National Committee, he was unsympathetic. "I held this matter open for months and allowed plenty of time to make selections, and none of you had a word to say." Ironically, he was quite capable of being close-mouthed himself, but only when the sensibilities of other people or governments had to be considered, or important announcements delayed. And sometimes, as now, he preferred the quick efficiency of a news leak. A White House source informed reporters that George B. Cordelieu would become Postmaster General after the election in place of Henry Clay Payne. This was a strategic move aimed at enhancing the former's authority as party chairman. Campaign workers were sure to obey Cordelieu if they knew he would soon inherit the government's richest patronage agency. Roosevelt assembled the rest of his second-term cabinet at leisure and mostly in secret. "He wants us all to resign," John Hay noted in his diary, "but he wants to reappoint me." Agriculture Secretary James Wilson might be kept on, Hay thought. Treasury Secretary Leslie Shaw, who had presidential ambitions for 1908, probably not. Taft he wants to keep either where he is or as Attorney General if Knox goes. This was the first recorded indication that Knox's astigmatic gaze had begun to focus beyond the administration. Like Taft, his dearest wish was to sit at center bench on the Supreme Court. But Chief Justice Fuller, at 71, remained annoyingly healthy. Meanwhile, the passing of Matthew Quay gave Knox an irresistible chance to represent his home state in the Senate. In any case, the president's latest preference for a Supreme Court appointment was William H. Moody. To that end, Roosevelt decided definitely to shift Moody to the Justice Department as soon as Knox resigned. He had other long-range plans for Taft. With less than a month to go before the convention in Chicago, he became obsessive about controlling every last detail. He plotted the Coliseum's seating plan, insisting that every Republican editor in the country be accommodated. He selected the speakers and edited the speeches. "For all we know," the New York Evening Post jibed, "he may have designated the men who are to lead the cheering." Representatives of state committees were amazed at his knowledge of what they were doing and whom they were hiring. "Mr. President, I have come for your final answer," Albert J. Beveridge said one day, crowding his desk like an earnest schoolboy. "Am I or am I not to be temporary chairman of the Chicago Convention?" As tactfully as possible, Roosevelt mentioned the name of somebody taller. Beveridge stiffened. "Root? Elihu Root? What can he say that the country will listen to?" Unconsoled, the little Hoosier performed one of his imitations of Napoleon retiring to Elba. "Very well, Mr. President, so be it. I am once more alone. Alone at school, alone at the bar, alone in the Senate, alone in the party. Good morning, Mr. President." Roosevelt's next visitor found the president convulsed with laughter. Roosevelt did not read Rasuli's list of demands until 28 May. He sent for Hay in a hurry and asked what the State Department thought of them. Hay said they were preposterous. The United States could not possibly force their acceptance on the Sultan. Personally, he would like Mr. Perdicaris's life to be saved. But a nation cannot degrade itself to prevent ill treatment of a citizen. The president seemed to agree. However, that afternoon a Navy Department cable went out to Admiral Jewell's European squadron east of the Azores, ordering it to proceed to Tangier at once. With the South Atlantic squadron already dispatched, some 30,000 tons of American gunmetal should soon persuade the Sultan to start negotiating. At 5:30 a.m. on 30 May, the white turrets of the Brooklyn appeared off Tangier. Her big guns boomed a long salute. Moroccan cannons politely boomed back. Admiral Chadwick's other three ships, the Atlanta, Castine, and Marietta, glided in at intervals through the day. Each in turn sent its salute, and the cannons answered. The prolonged, stately thudding was music to Samuel Gummery's ears. That night, four Marines, armed only with pistols, slipped ashore to guard the consul and Mrs. Perdicaris. More thudding on 1 June announced the arrival of Admiral Jewell's cruisers, Olympia, Baltimore, and Cleveland. Unnoticed in all the excitement, one of Rasuli's agents left town and galloped to Saradan in the mountains. He breathlessly reported the arrival of the American warships, one after the other. Tangier was Makloob, upside down. Mr. Perdicaris listened, his heart surging with patriotic gratitude. His only fear was whether this messenger, too, would have his throat slit. But Rasuli seemed pleased at the pressure building upon Abdulaziz. "The presence of these vessels," he said, "may result in his acceding to my demands, and then you will be able to return to your friends." 7 days after the arrival of the last American warship in Tangier Bay, Gummery was able to communicate only an unofficial, preliminary hint that the Sultan might deal with Rasuli. Roosevelt's patience began to run out, and Hay cabled, "President wishes everything possible done to secure the release of Perdicaris. He wishes it clearly understood that if Perdicaris is murdered, this government will demand the life of the murderer. You are to avoid in all your official action anything which may be regarded as an encouragement to brigandage or blackmail." Before nightfall, Tangier advised that the Moroccan government had formally accepted Rasuli's terms, except the huge ransom, which would have to be reasonably negotiated. On 10 June, Governor Samuel Pennypacker announced that Philander Chase Knox had been appointed to succeed Matthew Quay as senator. Roosevelt accepted the Attorney General's resignation, but no longer with Dickensian emotions. He wrote effusively, carelessly, "Knox was replaceable, as Root had proved to be." Even so, the president's words were sweet enough for Knox to paste them in his scrapbook. "Many great and able men have preceded you in the office you hold, but there is none among them whose administration has left so deep a mark. You have deeply affected for good the development of our entire political system in its relations to the industrial and economic tendencies of the time." Behind the exchange of courtesies lay some personal disillusionment. Roosevelt had grown impatient with the Attorney General's obsessive legalism. Knox was critical of the president's autocratic tendencies, particularly in the area of executive prerogative. And he was quick to reject press speculation that he would be an antitrust crusader on Capitol Hill. "President Roosevelt's policies are his own," he told reporters. "I have been no more than the exponent of his ideas." John Hay forwarded another demand from Rasuli to Roosevelt on 15 June. The Berber now wanted control of 4 more Moroccan districts. "You see, there is no end to the insolence of this blackguard," Hay wrote. "I feel that it would be most inexpedient to surrender to him. We have done what we can for Perdicaris. Who knows what he will ask next?" The secretary's desire to disengage betrayed a secret embarrassment. Researchers at the State Department were beginning to suspect that Mr. Perdicaris might not be an American citizen after all. Hay was anxiously awaiting their final report. How would delegates to the Chicago Convention react if the president was found to have bombarded Morocco in behalf of a fraudulent old Greek? Roosevelt, unsuspecting, asked Hay to explore the possibility of a joint military expedition with Britain and France. "Our position must be to demand the death of those who harm him, if he is harmed." Hay unhappily consulted with the envoys of both countries. Neither liked Roosevelt's idea. Jules Jusserand was particularly wary. An American landing at Tangier might threaten France's own program for total acquisition of Morocco. Pacification, as it was called on the Quai d'Orsay. He was astute enough to sense that Hay did not really want him to agree. "The president's will is, more and more, predominant in public affairs," Jusserand informed Foreign Minister Théophile Delcassé, "and he hesitates less and less to follow it, despite the advice of his cabinet officers. They, to tell the truth, resist only very weakly." Similar complaints came from Chicago, where the Republican National Committee was already meeting. Senator Nathan B. Scott, the acting chairman, objected bitterly to the way George Cortelyou had been foisted upon the party. Roosevelt, hearing that the old guard was plotting a last-minute revolt, responded forcefully by telegram, "People may as well understand that if I am to run for president, then Cortelyou is to be chairman. I will not have it any other way." He asked for the names of the intriguers, whereupon their opposition faded, but not their resentment. "Your Uncle Theodore knows how to run things," Scott growled at a newspaperman. On Monday, 20 June, the mass of Republican delegates arrived in Chicago. They looked languorous, almost bored under their straw hats. As Henry Cabot Lodge wrote Roosevelt, "Excitement is impossible where there is no contest." Old-timers talked nostalgically about the last really fought-out Republican convention in 1884. Some remembered 25-year-old Theodore Roosevelt of New York standing on a chair and yelling for a roll call in his high, harsh voice. They remembered drunken roars for James G. Blaine, glee clubs bellowing the praises of President Arthur, and that softest yet most penetrating of noises, the rustle of boodle, as Southern blacks sold and resold their votes. Now, 2 decades later, Chicago could have been hosting a temperance Chautauqua. No bunting brightened the streets. Sidewalks were bare of button hawkers and barkers. Every fakir with anything to sell had decamped to the World's Fair in St. Louis. Dull clouds scudded over Lake Michigan. The wind felt heavy and wet. That evening, Roosevelt dictated a letter to Kermit. Tomorrow the National Convention meets, and barring a cataclysm, I shall be nominated. How the election will turn out, no one can tell. The possibility, however remote, that he might be beaten, caused an access of pride and gratitude for nearly 3 years of power. From Panama on down, I have been able to accomplish certain things which will be of lasting importance in our history. Incidentally, I don't think that any family has ever enjoyed the White House more than we have. I was thinking about it just this morning when Mother and I took breakfast on the portico and afterwards walked about the lovely grounds and looked at the stately, historic old house. It is a wonderful privilege to have been here and to have been given the chance to do this work, and I should regard myself as having a small and mean mind if, in the event of defeat, I felt soured at not having had more, instead of being thankful for having had so much. Long before proceedings began on Tuesday, word spread that the President would monitor every minute of every session via a special telephone line running direct from his office to the basement of the Coliseum. Delegates began to get uneasy feelings of remote control. A disgusted Pennsylvanian decided not to attend. The boss has fixed it all up, and we might as well go home. One thing Roosevelt had neglected to fix, however, was the Coliseum's decor. As a result, it was not his portrait that greeted people entering the hall at noon. An enormous painting of Mark Hanna, 7 feet wide and 20 feet tall, hung over the speaker's platform. 28 other Hannas looked down somberly from various angles. In further evidence of old guard aesthetics, a black-draped chair was set aside for Senator Quay, and the dead features of President McKinley appeared on every admission ticket. "In every corner of the hall there is a ghost," a reporter observed. Even some of the living looked sepulchral when they sat under tobacco-blue sunbeams slanting down from the skylight. A question buzzed from aisle to aisle. "Where is Roosevelt's picture?" Sharp eyes eventually noticed a few small steel engravings spaced around the upper gallery and almost smothered in festoons. At 12:14, another pallid figure, Postmaster General Payne, clearly not long for the world, approached the rostrum and gaveled the 13th Republican National Convention to order. Elihu Root rose to respectful applause and began his keynote speech. In the vast space, his husky voice failed to carry. "The responsibility of government rests upon the Republican Party, the complicated machinery through which 80 million people..." "Louder!" a voice called. "Louder!" In Washington, it was an hour later by the clock, and the President was having lunch. He knew exactly what themes were being sounded in Chicago. Root had promised to trumpet, insofar as quiet Elihu could trumpet anything, the achievements of the last 4 years, from an administration rather than from a personal standpoint. There would be solemn fanfares on the names of McKinley and Hanna, rising scales of economic statistics, a canon on party and patriotism, and always the reassuring basso ostinato of continuity. Root may not be a virtuoso performer, but nobody could match his mastery of political polyphony. In Tangier it was nearly 5 hours further on. Late afternoon sun beat on the 7 white warships in Tangier Bay. They made a deceptively peaceful picture. Today, 21 June, was supposed to have seen the release of Mr. Perdicaris and his stepson, or so Consul Gummery had been led to believe, after the Sultan's latest yielding to Rasuli's demands. But the trail down from Saradan had remained quiet. Morocco, as Gummery complained, was a country of delays. Aboard the Brooklyn, he and Admiral Chadwick had decided that the United States could not tolerate any more double-dealing and treachery, either on the part of Rasuli or the Moroccan government. "We have come to a point when our position has now become undignified and humiliating," Gummery cabled Hay. Chadwick joined him in suggesting an ultimatum immediately for large indemnity for every day's further delay, and that Marines will be landed and customs seized. By now, Root's voice had strengthened, and most delegates were with him. They applauded his depersonalized summary of the administration's fiscal, antitrust, agricultural, and foreign policies. They received in silence the news that 5 battleships, 4 cruisers, 4 monitors, and 34 torpedo destroyers and torpedo boats had joined the Navy since 1900, while another 13 battleships and 13 cruisers were under construction. As Root approached his peroration, the applause grew louder and more frequent. He began to refer delicately to William McKinley's successor. He quoted the honest pledge of unbroken continuity given at Buffalo on 14 September 1901 to further cheers. "Our president," he declared with a sweeping gesture, "has taken the whole people into his confidence." "All except the members of the National Committee," Senator Scott murmured. Root did not enunciate the words "Theodore Roosevelt" until his final sentence at 1:18 p.m. There was a gratifying roar, but it died in 30 seconds. At 2:10 p.m., the convention adjourned for the day, and Henry Cabot Lodge's Committee on Resolutions began to write the party platform. Simultaneously, Consul Gummery's cable arrived in Washington. Hay pondered the cable overnight. More and more he dreaded an American show of force. European reactions would be negative and could turn hostile when, as now seemed certain, Mr. Perdicaris was revealed to be a Greek. A report from Athens confirmed that one Yannis Perdicaris had applied for Greek citizenship there at the start of the American Civil War. Yannis certainly sounded similar to Jan. Unable to confront Roosevelt with this news, Hay asked a deputy, Gaylord Hunt, to take the Perdicaris file over to the White House, along with a recommendation that Rasuli and the Sultan be given a final warning. As commander-in-chief, not to mention political candidate, Roosevelt must consider the risks. Hunt came back and said that the president had not been at all pleased with the contents of the file. However, he had authorized Hay's suggested ultimatum. Rightly or wrongly, Rasuli believed Mr. Perdicaris to be American. He had therefore done deliberate violence to the whole concept of American citizenship. For that he must be held responsible, and the Sultan responsible for him. Once again it was afternoon in Morocco, as Roosevelt conducted his mid-morning audience, and delegates in the Chicago Coliseum awaited the noon opening gavel. Hay, drafting his ultimatum, hit upon a concise impropriety to gratify the aggressive Gummery. It nicely balanced the more cautious phraseology that followed. "We want Perdicaris alive or Rasuli dead. Further than this, we desire least possible complications with Morocco or other powers. You will not arrange for landing Marines or seizing Custom House without specific directions from the department." Hay could not resist showing his draft to Edwin M. Hood, the veteran State Department correspondent for the Scripps-McRae News Service. "Think I'll send it," he said, as one old newspaperman to another. "Then I will too," Hood replied. The message went out over government and news wires simultaneously, but by the time it reached Morocco, Gummery had no need for it. An upcountry sheik announced that he would make his village available for the exchange of hostages and ransom on the next morning, 23 June. Hood's dispatch reached Chicago at about 3 p.m., and a copy was delivered to the permanent chairman of the convention, Joseph Cannon. He let it lie on his desk while Henry Cabot Lodge read the Republican Party platform for 1904. Hood's dispatch reached Chicago at about 3 p.m., and a copy was delivered to the permanent chairman of the convention, Joseph Cannon. He let it lie on his desk while Henry Cabot Lodge read the Republican Party platform for 1904. "We declare our constant adherence to the following principles," Lodge shouted. His voice rang with the earnestness of a politician, determined to say as little as possible. He was noncommittal on the tariff, trust control, labor relations, and foreign policy. The future of the Philippines was left vague. Disenfranchised Negroes got a few words of sympathy. Insurgent Republicans, none. There was no call for railroad rate regulation, no acknowledgment of the Iowa idea, no mention of the power war between Governor La Follette and Senator Spooner. the latter's old guard delegation doggedly occupied Wisconsin floor space, courtesy of the Committee on Credentials. When Lodge finished, Cannon called for acceptance of the platform. There was a unanimous, if apathetic, chorus of ayes. Cannon, smiling, took up his slip of paper. "With the consent of the convention, the chair will direct the clerk to read a dispatch from Washington, received through the courtesy of the Scripps McRae Newspaper Association." "Bulletin," the clerk read. "Washington, June 22. Secretary of State Hay has sent instructions to Consul General Samuel R. Gummery as follows. We want either Perdicaris alive or Rasuli dead." After 2 days of procedural torpor, the convention reacted galvanically to Hay's concise impropriety. Delegates jumped on their chairs and shouted with delight. "Roosevelt and Hay know what they are doing," a Kansan exulted. "Our people like courage. We'll stand for anything those men do." Cannon quickly adjourned the session, content to let enthusiasm build for the nominations. A few minutes before 11 o'clock, on Thursday, 23 June, Frank S. Black, a former governor of New York, rose to nominate the president. Immensely tall and craggy, he glared through professional spectacles and shook a boyish thatch of hair. "From every nook and corner of the country," he orated, "rises but a single choice to fill the most exalted office in the world." Applause welled up, as if echoing his metaphor. Roosevelt had chosen well. Black, his predecessor in Albany, was the party's best speaker, more poetic than Spooner, less preachy than Hoar. After some more flights of populist imagery, Black got down to the personal. He reminded the convention that Roosevelt, for all his fame as a soldier, was by nature a writer and scholar. A profound student of history, he is today the greatest history maker in the world. However, the fate of nations is still decided by their wars. The peace that scholars craved was probably illusory, certainly temporary. Events are numberless and mighty, and no man can tell which wire runs around the world. The nation basking today in the quiet of contentment and repose may be still on the deadly circuit, and tomorrow writhing in the toils of war. This is the time when great figures must be kept in front. If the pressure is great, the material to resist it must be granite and iron. Whether we wish it or not, America is abroad in this world.